Hello, everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. I'm Kenneth Amadori, and I got a returning guest on the line. And I looked at the last time we did an interview. It was in 2017. It was some time ago. It was a great interview, actually. I recommend people to go back and listen to it. But we're going to get refreshed on the topics of that interview. And I think it might be a little controversial. We're going to have a discussion today and really a question the way the Western civilization is versus what's going on in China and mantras and myths and, you know, the propaganda that's behind a lot of things. I got Jeff J. Brown on the line. He's with China Rising Sinoland, author of multiple books, The Economist, and he's the author of the China Trilogy, blogs and podcasts at China Rising Sinoland, and is the producer of China Tech News Flash, and is the curator of the Bioweapon Truth Commission Global Online Library. His forthcoming book, Faster Than a Speeding Bullet, The Chinese People's Unstoppable Socialist Dream for Global Leadership into the 22nd Century, will be released in December of 2020. My goodness, if 2020 wasn't as hard-hitting enough, we got Jeff's book coming out at the end of the year here. My goodness, Jeff. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the show with me today. Appreciate your time here.
Thank you for having me back on. And I, too, remember our interview, and I really appreciate you having me back. And so much has happened since 2017. And as you said, the China story is something that more people should pay attention to. And so I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Just fire away, and I will tell you exactly what I think, believe, or know.
Well, first of all, let's get into it. Obviously, there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to China versus the U.S. The U.S. has this dynamic of capitalism, or seemingly capitalist economy. And obviously, we know that's not true. There's a whole spectrum of capitalist versus socialism, and there's a big mix of that going on. And arguably, we're getting more and more socialist as time goes on here. And so China has been established as a communist country. And the question is why is China growing so much? And are people happy under this communist regime? And I'm sure it's similar over there too. There's a whole spectrum of communism. It's not just one size fits all. But that's the research that you've done. You've devoted your career to this. So that's what I want to talk about today. Let's understand the dynamic of what is going on in China, especially as it pertains to how it compares to the U.S. and the West.
Okay, that's a wonderful question. And like I said, I wrote three books, about 1,600, 1,500 pages, and have written about 600 articles on my website about this. So it's a really important question, because there is a looking like a clash of civilizations, you know, happening. And I wish it wasn't that way, but that's the way it's falling out. The huge differences between Western civilization and Chinese civilization. First off, Western civilization goes back to ancient Greece, and ancient Greece was not a unified civilization. In fact, it was hundreds of little city-states, dozens of languages. Everything was based on commerce. You know, this city-state selling to this city-state, etc. And they were very expansionist. They and people don't realize, but Greece, ancient Greece, expanded all the way up into the Black Sea, and expanded out a lot more than people realize. So Western culture has this tendency of being expansionist, you know, going out looking for resources. And one of the reasons is because they didn't have a lot of resources in ancient Greece. It was, you know, dry, not a lot of rain, you know, limited resources on these islands and even in Greece and Turkey, et cetera. So there's this concept of what I call the Marlboro Man. There's this independence, you know, the rugged individualist, you know, trading, you know, between these different, you know, city states and island states. Because of that, because of all of these different little groups of these different islands, there was a lot of war. I mean, they were at war nonstop. And so this is the cauldron or the crucible. This is the crucible in which Western civilization developed. Independence, expansionism, commerce, and unfortunately, a lot of war. China, we can say started, you know, always started before the ancient Greece, but even if we go back to this 700 BC, when ancient Greece started, that was when Confucius Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, that's when they lived. And by 700 BC, China was already a vastly developed civilization. And it's always, instead of being dispersed and small, it has always had this concept of centralization and trying to make everybody common, similar. The language has not changed much for 5,000 years. And that language is what has kept the country together spiritually and culturally, you know, going back for, you know, 3,000-4,000 years. So we're still using the same language. And because of this idea of being centralized and working together, it's totally different. I'm not saying China didn't have wars. They had lots. They had a lot of wars. But once China expanded out into its natural boundaries, basically the Yellow River, in the north, and the Yangtze River in the south, once they expanded out to those in north and south of those two, you know, immensely important river valleys, river basins, they didn't go tearing off into Asia or tearing off down into Southeast Asia. They pretty much stayed in their neck of the woods. To give you an idea about the difference, in the year 200 AD, when Rome, the Roman, of course, the Greeks, you know, kind of transitioned their civilization into the Roman civilization. And in 200 AD, when Rome was at its greatest, at its the pinnacle of its domination of the Mediterranean basin and England and North Africa and the Middle East and Egypt, at that time, the Chinese, China as we know it today, had 9 times as many people and was 6 times bigger in area. And so China has always been big. China has always been populated. And one of the things that people have, that Westerners need to start getting wrap their heads around, is that for 5,000 years until, you know, basically the 1500s, when the U.S. expanded, not the U.S., but Europe, expanded across the planet with colonialism, China was the technological behemoth of the world. I mean, they were centuries ahead of Europe in almost every phase of technology. For 110 years, from 1839 until 1949, the West got the best of China. The country was weak in terms of leadership of the Qing dynasty, and the West, England, and then the United States and France, principally those three colonial imperial powers, were at the height of their colonialism, and they were able to basically for 110 years rape and plunder China. And force opium on them for, you know, and with 25% of the population addicted to opium. And so unfortunately, and it's at the West peril, they have this idea that that's the China that they're working with. They're ignoring the fact that for the 5,000 years before that, China was the most advanced culturally, civilizationally, scientifically, and technologically in the world for almost all of written human history. And they came back in 1949, and they've just gotten stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and bigger and richer, and they're back. You know, China's back after a 110-year hiatus during what they call the century of humiliation, when the West raped and plundered China during and addicted it to opium. They're back. They are back where they have been for 5,000 years, and that's why we're seeing, I think, all of this tremendous confrontation, because the West cannot accept the fact that China is not the China that it was from 1839 to 1949.
So, Jeff, let's talk about that a little bit. And I don't want to minimalize just what the West did to colonialism only. I mean, there's a certain degree of what the U.S. experienced, which was opportunity and freedom, and just boiling things down to human action. When individuals have an opportunity to go out and create something and thrive, I mean, it creates productivity and efficiencies and new technologies, opportunities, all these things that are afforded when you have an opportunity and liberties, which I wholeheartedly believe in. And I think we have to attribute some of that success to why we saw some prosperity here in the U.S. And so to flip that, many people would argue that the communism, you know, will hinder that, will get in the way of that inner drive that humans have to go out and produce and save and acquire capital, hire other people, start businesses that really get an economy going. So if you would talk to us a little bit more about the economic drivers, you know, what's driving people on an individual level to really grow China? Why is China growing under a communist government?
Well, first off, China has been, in fact, I just read a wonderful book about the history of China, and he really gets into the economics and translated a lot of documents going back and talking about commerce. I mean, being a 5,000-year-old civilization, and it's basically a continuous civilization, the longest existing one in human history. The Chinese, I mean, you don't have 9 times the population and 6 times the area of China of ancient Rome without there being commerce. And so the Chinese have always been involved in commerce. The Chinese are the ones that started the Silk Road, the Silk Roads from China, and China in 200 BC, before Jesus Christ was even born, the Chinese were sending emissaries and commercial teams. And traded with the Roman Empire. They traded with all of the people of what is now Europe and Asia. There are records in China has official records of trading with the Philippines in 600 AD. You know, the China was trading with Indonesia and Australia hundreds of years before Captain Cook, you know, landed in New Zealand. He didn't discover it. The Chinese were there centuries before. In the 15th century, and I actually interviewed a guy named John A. Hobson, and he wrote a really wonderful book. The Chinese have been trading with Africa. They've been trading with the Muslim world since the rise of Islam in the 700s. They've been trading with India going back at least to 500 AD, and then with the Euro-Asian tip of Asia, Europe, you know, the North Africa and everything. They've been doing that for 2,200 years. So to say that, and the other thing is that it was, China has had massive, they were the first to develop iron and steel and porcelain and many other technologies long before Europe had them. And so they have been so advanced technologically that they have also been very advanced commercially. To say that, so they understand, they're business people. They understand business. They understand that. And it was largely, and they had massive agriculture, you know, lots of trade. I mean, are just, you know, roads and canals. They built huge canals, you know, all over the country to transport, you know, goods and agricultural products all over the country. So, and in my second book, China Rising, I start the book out rather controversially by saying China's been communist for 5,000 years. And all the way back to the Shang Dynasty, you know, in 2750 BC. I mean, they have always had this concept of the collective. They've always had this concept of group. They've always had this concept of you know, working together, which is, again, different than the Greek Marlboro man individual, you know, rugged individualist. So they have been, for them to, for a Chinese government during the Tang Dynasty in 600 AD to ask the people in the Yangtze River Valley to contribute their time to building irrigation canals and flood control and all that, to get hundreds of thousands of people to work together on these huge projects, the Chinese are used to that. So there is this sense of collectivity. There is this a really strong sense of solidarity. And so when the Chinese, the Communist Party of China was formed in 1921, and when the communists kicked the Japanese fascists and the Western imperialists out of China, we can't forget the KMT, the gangster KMT that ended up in Taiwan, when they had officially become, you know, a communist country in 1949, wasn't that big of a deal for the Chinese. Because they'd been working in this same kind of solidarity, collectiveness, a real sense of community for millennia.
Yeah. Jeff, let me jump in right there. I mean, would you give us an idea of what exactly is communistic about China? You know, how does it affect the regular person? Or, you know, what sort of taxes are they seeing? What sort of controls on their life do they have? What exactly does that term translate into for an average Chinese person?
Well, for to be a communist socialist, you know, country, there is what they call the vanguard party, the vanguard political party, to keep things together. Excuse me. And in China, that's the Communist Party of China. And you know, it's really interesting. I mean, there's so much propaganda in the West about there's so much ridiculous propaganda in the West about China and its history during the Mao Zedong years. But it's also, it's very democratic at the local level. There's a lot of democracy at the local level. And Mao was constantly trying to push, you know, create people's democracy down at the village and street and neighborhood level. So, you know, basically, there is a vanguard party. There are actually more political parties in China than there are in the United States. The Chinese have the vanguard party, which is the CPC, the Communist Party of China, but it also has what's called the Democratic Front, and it's about 8 different political parties that are everything from pretty much neoliberal to sort of market oriented to European socialism. They are there to keep the Communist Party honest and to keep the government honest. They are not going to be allowed to be let into power, just as, you know, they won't let Bernie Sanders run for president. The United States, they wouldn't let Jeremy Corbyn run for prime minister in England. They made sure that the people that could potentially upset the dominant system, they're not going to allow those people to run for serious office. We're never going to see a socialist or a green president in the United States ever. And it's over in England after Margaret Thatcher. So no one, the people at least governmentally, politically, Chinese Communist Party is the dominant party, but 1/3 of the National People's Congress is non-CPC. I mean, they've got a lot of people. Most of the people, in fact, the vast majority of the people who are elected, and China has, after India, has more elections than anybody else in the world. They have 900,000 voting, villages and towns, et cetera, neighborhoods. I mean, when we were living there, I could see, you could see the candidate, the list of candidates who were running for the local town council or the local village council or the local neighborhood council. The vast majority of them are not members of the CPC. They're just citizens.
So let me jump in there. It almost seemed like you're telling me how not communist China is. Like all these things that are not representative of like a traditional far right or left communist established country.
Well, I don't know. First off, I don't think people in the West get an honest appraisal of communism or socialism for that matter. I mean, I was brainwashed when I was growing up, completely brainwashed from the womb all the way up through, you know, when I finally left the United States in 1980. I think your concept of communism is very common, and I empathize with people in the United States, and it's better in Europe because there is a communist party here in France, and there's a communist party in Italy, and although they've been completely suppressed, but at least the idea of communism and socialism is quite prevalent in Europe. But not in the United States. I mean, by the time we got to McCarthy, socialism and communism were destroyed in the United States, and so people have no idea what it is, and they only know what they've read in the textbooks and listened to on mainstream TV or mainstream media. So,
let me jump in right there. When it comes to, and I like to really boil things down to very individual level. Like, how does this affect the regular person? And, you know, when it comes to socialism, you know, in a small sample, I mean, we talk about the classroom example, right? You know, if you had to give everyone an opportunity to study for a test and everyone had an opportunity to thrive, get an A or fail, people would have to go out, all the kids would have to study and put their best foot forward, and some would get A's, some would fail. But if you told everyone that they were going to get a C, then you would have the situation where the people that were going to try really hard are not going to try hard. The people who weren't going to try are still not going to try. And you're going to have a net loss of productivity and effort put forward in that example. So that's a very extreme socialistic example versus maybe an extreme free market. Hey, you go out there and do it. I mean, what's the bridging of the gap that you like, or is it, do you Do you like that example of everyone getting a C? I mean, where do you fit on that? But not
everybody in China gets a C. I mean, in fact, China is.
But it's not a completely communistic society. That's right. There's aspects of free market and liberties and things that you're talking about that there's afforded. It's not a completely communistic environment.
Well, but again, you're suggesting that communism can't have those things. And I'm saying they do. China, listen, Kenneth, man, I empathize with you and I empathize with everybody watching this show. Until I went back to China in 2010, I had these same ideas. I mean, I was so fixated on the Western concept of democracy. I was so fixated on the Western concept of freedom and everything. But now, after spending another 10 years there, I realized that, well, you know, gosh, there are other forms of democracy. There are other ways of arriving at the same point. In fact, China is the most ruthless meritocracy in the world. I mean, it is brutal. And it has been that way for 5,000 years. You know, you would never have someone like Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. But for example, you would never have someone like Donald Trump become president of China. I'm not criticizing Trump, but I'm just saying that in China, if you want to be the leader of among the leadership or play a role in the governance of the country, you have to spend decades of your life proving yourself, crawling up the ladder, proving your point, whether it's a state-owned company or a government entity or in education. Every year, 9 million Chinese take the what they call the Gaokao, the huge test that determines what kind of university you go to. China is brutally meritocratic, and most Westerners couldn't handle it. They just couldn't handle it.
Well, and I don't want to get hung up on terminology and labels, right, left, Republican, conservative, communism, socialism. I really want to talk about the actions. Like, for instance, in 2020, we had a situation where the government said, hey, everyone needs to stay at home. You can't go to work. Businesses can't make money. I mean, to me, that is a top-down power, a lot of power coming from the top, which arguably is unconstitutional. And, again, not trying to get too much of the labels, but, you know, as someone who grew up in the U.S., I would say, oh, that's totalitarian. Oh, that's communism. That's too much power coming from the government.
Wow.
Let's not get caught up on that. But for me, I don't think that's free market capitalism happening here in the West. That's a lot of power. And I don't agree with that, if you will. I think, you know, we're going into a period where, you know, we might have a Biden, Kamala Harris presidency. And they're going to suggest things like higher taxes on the wealthy, the rich, capital gains. And to me, on a very fundamental individual basis, that disincentivizes growth here in the U.S. In fact, it might incentivize more people to invest elsewhere around the world. And for, again, so that top-down, lot of power from the top, control over the people, you know, that's not free market. That's not incentivizing growth here in the U.S. So talk to that. Again, I don't want to just say, okay, the U.S. is capitalism, China is socialism. Let's talk about like real issues.
Okay, two things. First off, China has an authoritarian government. It's been authoritarian for 5,000 years. I mean, and the Chinese expect it and they want it because the Chinese, the government, the leadership, the people, they want social harmony, they want economic prosperity, and they want their borders protected from outside invaders. In other words, they want that. I think that the West, including Europe and the United States, NATO, what I call Euranglo land, I'm not impressed with the democracy. I think it's just as authoritarian as China, but they hide behind all these, you know, these 25 cent, you know, words like free market and freedom of the press and, you know, freedom of expression and all that other stuff. But to be honest with you, I mean, you know, when you really get down to it, it's not that free if you disagree with the mainstream convention. And I think it's been that way forever. Why are libertarian websites being shut down? Why are libertarian Twitter and Facebook accounts being shut down by the tens of thousands, as much as socialist and communist websites on both ends of the spectrum? They're being completely expunged. So I think we have always been very authoritarian in the West, but we've been brainwashed into believing that we're not, but really it is. And the COVID thing is a perfect example. And in China, they reacted to the COVID situation. I've written about it. I have a whole library. I wrote about 20 something articles. I interviewed all kinds of people in China about what happened with COVID there. It's all on my website. And they had to react because I think they know and the government knew that it was brought. And I don't want to get into the COVID thing, but they considered it to be an attack by the West. And I think they considered it to be an attack by the United States. I think they, just like SARS, they believe, and I think they were right, that it was an attack by the United States. And I think COVID was also an attack. And the government treated it that way. They considered it to be, they were on war footing. They were at war. And so they treated it that way. And so they went into social control that Westerners can't even begin to imagine. But because of this concept of solidarity, millennial cooperation, community and not individual, it worked really well. I mean, no other country except maybe, well, South Korea was very close to it. But China just went into overdrive and responded to it in an amazing fashion. So yeah, I agree with you. I don't think America's that free. I don't think Europe's that free. You know, it's really funny, Kenneth, you brought that up. The last time my daughter was here, she had been in China. She came back with us to China in 2010 and went to high school and just graduated from Beijing Normal University. And we were back here in what, maybe 2017 or 2018. She was maybe a freshman in college at Beijing Normal University. And we were sitting on Champs-Élysées. I mean, how could it get any better than Champs-Élysées, you know, in Paris, you know, Gay Paris. And we were having a coffee on Champs-Élysées. We were talking, and we had been in France for like two or three weeks. And, you know, it's a beautiful country, beautiful food, nice people. And she said, Daddy, you know, it's really strange. I feel freer in China than I do here. It's just like, yeah, well, the definition of freedom is not always the way the West defines it. And
right.
No, I cannot go out on Tiananmen Square and hold up a sign and say Xi Jinping sucks. because that would be a loss of face to the leadership, but I can go to my local committee and complain. But there's freedom in China that I'm not going to get robbed. I'm not going to get raped. I'm not going to get, there's almost no street crime. It's safe. You can travel. In fact, the biggest outbound tourist country in the world is China. 100 and something million Chinese leave every year and travel all over the world. So now it wasn't always that way, but I'm just saying concepts of freedom are also very, very debatable.
Absolutely. And I think that's what it all comes down to. And that would be my goal in terms of some sort of utopian societies, give people their freedom. And I think that's what people want. And I think that's what establishes a good groundwork for productivity and the greatest benefit for all. So Jeff, I want to appreciate you for coming on the show with me today and just sharing your insights and your thoughts and kind of opening up this idea of, hey, you know, what's going on in China. You know what? I want to ask you like one final wrap up, like talk to us about the growth of China. What do you see happening over the next 5 to 10 years? We've seen China grow tremendously over the last few decades. Talk to us about where China is going over the next 5 to 10 years and maybe the dynamic of what you see changing in the global landscape.
Well, it's a good question. And another thing is that everybody said there was no growth during the Mao era. And of course, that's just rubbish. The GDP average for China from 1949 to 1978, when Deng Xiaoping assumed power and changed the policies to reform and opening up, was 6 point something%. And in the United States, it was 7% over the same time period. So this growth has been going on since 1949, not just since Deng Xiaoping with the reforms and opening up. The reason that China is growing so spectacularly is because they have what I call socialist vision. This goes back to the days of, Lenin and Stalin, the five-year plan, the big five-year plan. This is where the government and the leadership and the business people and everybody, they get together and they sit down and they map out what they're going to do for the next 5 years. So that way everybody's on the same page. Everybody knows, well, we're going to try to build 80,000 kilometers of railway in the next 5 years. We're going to try to open 10 deep water ports in the next 5 years. We're going to open 5,000 new grade schools in the next 5 years. And it just, 1,000 hospitals. And it just goes on and on and on. And so they started doing the five-year plans after Mao, during Mao's administration in the 50s. And that kind of planning allows business people to really excel and develop. Because if I know that the government is going to set policy to where we're going to have 1,000 schools built in the next 5 years, and I'm in construction, and I'm a construction company, then I can plan on that. And so it just, and so this has been going on since 1949. They've had these five-year plans. Now they're doing rolling 10-year plans. They do the five-year plan, but they're rolling into the next 5 year. So now they're really stretching out to 10 years. If something's not working, they take it to the legislature, the National People's Congress, and they do an amendment to a law or a policy or whatever. They're constantly assessing, reassessing, and trying to improve the chances for people to succeed. They're not going to leave, for example, they're not going to allow Bitcoin you know, to take over in China. They took over block technology, blockchain technology, and they took it, and now they're going to make it a benefit, you know, for all the people. So they do this tremendous planning. And in fact, one of the reasons that the United States was in such a panic was when China came out with its Made in China 2025. This goes back 2 or 3 years ago, where China came up with a policy, a structural policy, to that 80% of everything that is high tech by 2025 would be made domestically. And of course, that freaked the United States out because they realized that if the China could do that, then it would be tough for the United States to compete. You know, they've been mapping out 5G for 10 years. And the US and Europe don't even really have any 5G to speak of. I mean, it's there, but it's a mess. So that they even have another one, 2035. They have another goal for 2035. They have vision, and they don't care about the next quarterly report. You know, they are thinking, and when I said, you know, into the 22nd century, they're already thinking about the next century. You know, I mean, they are already planning for the 22nd century. So when you have a culture that's been around for 5,000 years and they've survived for 5,000 years and they've been the most advanced, developed, richest civilization for the last 5,000 years, except for 110 years when the West got the best of them, they're used to this kind of visionary, you know, millennial thinking. So that's why the U.S., I mean, I tell people this all the time, the West cannot compete against China. They cannot, unless they start. You know when the U.S. really, really, you know, hummed and really kicked ass industrially. It's when the U.S. government essentially nationalized the industrial capacity for World War II, and when they had that, America was producing steel and ships and trains and, you know, okay, that's what China does every day. And so we did it for a few years to win World War II. Now, I mean, China's been doing it for 5,000 years and that's why they are kicking the West's butt. And that's why, what was it I just saw? I think in the second semester, the second quarter of this year, China already bounced back with the 3% growth. The United States was minus 33%. England was minus 20, and France was minus 13. And China grew 3.2%. Kenneth, let me tell you, it is not looking good for the West versus China for the next 5 to 10 years, because this completely different philosophy about how to run a country and help the people is just going to get large. It's going to get wider and wider and wider. And now the West is being destroyed by, I think it's the oligarch bankers and the deep state who are destroying the West to turn us into a one world government, in my opinion, and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the rich bankers are doing this. And so now China doesn't have that problem, and now we're saddled with all this COVID police state stuff, and China is just going to bury the West economically. You know, Kenneth, even the Economist and Financial Times in England and other publications came out in 2014 and 2015 and said that China already had the biggest economy in the world on a purchasing power parity basis. So, you can't compare Switzerland and Botswana on a on an exchange rate basis. You have to compare them by PPP, purchasing power parity. China's already the biggest economy. It's been that way now since 2014, 2015. It's just going to get even more and more divergent in the next 5 to 10 years, because they've already got a plan. They've got the next 10 years planned out. It's sobering, isn't it? It's really sobering.
Yeah. You know, and it's incredibly nuanced, my goodness. And then just even what happened this year with the virus and the changes. I mean, things can change so quickly with technology as well. I mean, it's so incredibly difficult and nuanced to wrap your mind around the dynamics of how the countries are moving forward and the changes on so many different facets. So I appreciate your insight on this, and I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your analysis and how you've formulated your life, really. I mean, you've really put your where your thoughts are. I mean, you've led your life to really follow this, follow your conviction. So I really appreciate that. If people want to learn more about you, the work you do, where can they go and what can they expect to find?
Well, you said you were going to put my stuff on the YouTube in the description down below the YouTube channel, but just to go to www.chinarising.punto press.com www.chinarising.puntopress.com, and that's my website, and everything's there, and I've got like 600 articles and going back to 2015 and tons of interviews and a lot of information. So I will be looking forward to sharing this video and spreading your good word in my area by promoting Crush the Street. And so I'll let all my fans know about you when I post this video on my website. And so we have win-win mutually beneficial cooperation, Kenneth. Just like Xi Jinping.
Okay. All right, Jeff. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.